9th of December, 1982. E.T. the Extraterrestrial is released in the UK with its memorable image of Elliot and E.T. on Elliot's Kuwahara BMX bike flying across the face of the moon. The bicycle was something of a status symbol in the 70s. The choice of bike was a yardstick of standing among your chums. One major decision was between the Raleigh Chopper and a racing bike. I chose a racer, or it chose me, seduced by that sleek beast look, and the old man found a top-notch second-hand beauty. And boy, I looked after it so carefully. I knew how to get the chain back on, and all the tricks of finding and fixing punches. If there wasn't a bowl of water handy, I could track down the split by spitting gob on the tyre and squeezing it until I found the tear. Not exactly classy, but practical. So why didn't I go for the chopper? It was cool in a low-tech, easy-rider kind of way, with those high handlebars and the padded lean-back seat. Great colours, fiery reds, oranges and yellows, metallic blue, but, and it's a big but, that stubby gear lever in the middle of the crossbar was naff. You knew it made no difference at all, only there for show. Bikes were only one of our transportation options. Back then, we would spend hours, days, constructing go-karts from the bits and bobs we scrounged off parents and neighbours, or nicked from building sites. Old pram wheels, discarded planks, bits of string for rudimentary steering. We were the original scrap-heap challengers. There was an endless choice of self-propelled vehicles, from roller skates and scooters to the space hopper, a Triumph, and the pogo stick, and stilts. Kids used to totter around on wooden stilts like escapees from Billy Smart's circus. This was a childhood spent outdoors, from 8 in the morning to 8 at night during the summer holidays. You weren't a true kid of the 70s until your knees were properly bruised and scabbed up. Think Chopper Harris. Not sure about the Segway. That futuristic electric two-wheeler you stand on, like riding along the back axle of a car with handlebars. Although it has more urban cachet than the Sinclair C5 ever could, you still look like a little kid who's got lost buzzing up the A1 on it. 31st of January, 1983. Compulsory wearing of seatbelts for drivers and front seat passengers comes into force in the UK. Safety on foot and on bikes was drilled into my generation by a succession of school visits from local coppers, road safety officers, Green Cross codemen and lollipop ladies, full of good advice on how to cross a road. There's been a change of emphasis from the simple delights of the Tufty Club. Look at road safety ads now. They're all aimed at the drivers with slow-mo shots of kids bouncing off car bonnets and enough post-trauma fakery to keep the casualty and Holby City makeup teams in work for years. What the road safety bods must have realised is that you can spend as much time as you like telling kids to look left, right and left again, and installing flashing green men across the country, but all this won't make a blind bit of frigging difference if the knob end at the wheel of his 4x4 is texting his bit of fluff as he completely ignores another pedestrian crossing. Back in the 1970s, drivers were pretty unrestricted. No sleeping policemen, speed bumps or cameras. And at night there were doubtless three powerful Irish coppers to the wind at a time when drinking and driving was almost acceptable. You didn't have to wear a seatbelt at all until 1983. And it was still legal for kids to be unbelted in the back until 1989. Clunk-click every trip was only a suggestion. Dangerous, of course, but it did mean you could lie flat out on the back seat all the way back from Devon, snoozing gently next to the pile of I Spy books, while smartly dressed AA and RAC officers saluted the passing car. 23rd of March, 1983. The album Eliminator is released by ZZ Top, whose drummer, Frank Beard, is famously the only band member without a gigantic beard. Jason King, the dapper, champagne-loving international sleuth, spy and seducer, played by Peter Wingard, was a fashion explosion. Bespoke velvet suits with waistcoat and fob chain, lurid silk shirt with matching tie, massive collar and cuffs which he turned up outside his suit, and hair and sideburns quaffed into a rigid helmet. But the final touch, the last detail that turned him into a 1970s icon, was the moustache. This was a classic of the times, a cross between a handlebar, a Frank Zappa, and a Zapata, a bristling declaration of such hetero-pulling power that when Wingard was busted for cottaging in the 1970s, it was a scandal of George Michael proportions. Alongside the Freddie Mercury Village People Tash, the ZZ Top beards, and the old-school stylings of Terry Thomas, Jimmy Edwards and Bruce Forsyth, I have to mention the Liverpool FC moustache. It was a constant feature of all the great Anfield sides of the era. Rush, Souness, Grobbelaar, even Loro, all sporting them like Samson, if not Kenny Samson, as a badge of pride and a source of strength. The gallery of facial hairstyles on offer to the pubescent child of the 1970s and 80s included the entrepreneur look of Richard Branson, a neat and tidy beard that found its expression on primetime TV in the form of Noel Evans and Jeremy Beadle. I could include the Bee Gees beards in that category too. Noel, of course, has had the same style since time immemorial. It's almost impossible to imagine him without it. In fact, it would be bloody horrendous. As horrendous as when Branson dressed as a bride. The stuff of nightmares. 13th of June, 1983. The first mobile phone to hit the market is released in the US. The Motorola Dynatac 8000X, known as the Brick. It retailed for $3,995. In those dim, distant years before I crept the boards in my youth, as Uncle Monty from Withnail and I put it, I worked for a while as a film publicist. One of the movies I worked on was The Fourth Protocol in 1987, and Freddie Forsyth, who'd written the novel, was in London to help with promotion. We'd organised a press screening at the Odeon Leicester Square, and at one point I looked across the foyer to see Freddie striding about and talking into a huge phone, with wires disappearing into a petrol tank that he was lugging around. By the time he rang off and put this bloody great case down, he looked like he'd dislocated his shoulder. With hindsight, this telecommunications beast was laughably gigantic, but at the time, it was dead impressive. The telecommunications revolution was nigh, and that meant the beginning of the end for the public phone box. No more could you spend hours collecting 2p's and 10p's to weigh down the pockets of your finest flares before standing politely outside the nearest red phone box, waiting for the guy inside to finish an interminable conversation with his girlfriend. How many crucial, emotionally charged conversations were cut off with mid-angst as the pips went and there were no 2p's left? At home, the heavy-duty, round-dial phone was the standard issue one. There wasn't any choice. And why did somebody choose 999 as the emergency number when it clearly took the longest possible time to dial? Surely 111 would have been quicker and might have saved vital seconds in a life-or-death situation. I know I'm not alone in seeing the mobile as a necessary evil. Brilliant for sorting out childcare arrangements, calling out the lifeboat, all that kind of stuff. But I think we're all aware of the downsides. Ringtones are a particular bête noire. Especially that little bête verte, the crazy frog. One species I would personally be happy to see hunted to extinction. And I prefer it if nobody ever texted me. The screen's too small and my fingers are too big to reply. We spent thousands of years perfecting language, and now we're back with hieroglyphics.